So today, I'm not going to preach on that gospel passage, so I'm glad you gave a good introduction to it. I'm going to look at that really familiar passage from Paul's first letter to the church in Corinth. Now, how many of you had that at your wedding? A bit of that at your wedding? I know I did. It's so common, you hear it so often. However, what Paul was speaking into and really getting at is way beyond what the average wedding couple is thinking about. So I'd like to try and get that across to you this morning. Even at our last wardens meeting, I remember someone saying something like, well, how do we love? So I hope that this provides an answer, or at least some of the answer, for all of us here. I'm going to start by describing a bit of the context of chapter 13 in 1 Corinthians and to lay out what Paul was really saying here. Then I'll look at some of the ways that contrasts to the way our world thinks about love. And then I'll look at what it means for us as St. Matthew's. So this chapter obviously is really well known, especially verses 4-7. And even though they're usually heard out of context, they seem very meaningful. But so much of the meaning that Paul was trying to get across is lost by not reading it in the context of the argument that Paul had been making so far and was making throughout his letter. And also the fact that this is part of a letter that Paul wrote to a specific group of people with specific circumstances that he was speaking into. So Paul's letter to the Corinthian Christians was written in response to a letter that they'd first sent him. And that apparently asked questions about various aspects of Christian life, especially about spiritual gifts and how they were to be used in the community when they were gathered in worship. He's particularly trying to counter the idea that they had already made it spiritually, that somehow they were so spiritually mature that they were already in heaven, so to speak. And he was also writing to a divided church where some considered themselves spiritual compared with others, particularly because they had particular spiritual gifts. And he was writing in response to some disturbing reports about what they did in their worship. You know, like not sharing food at the meal that they had around their communion and arguing over what they ate, specifically about eating meat that had been offered to idols. So basically, Paul was writing to a church that was having a really difficult time staying together. Now, in the chapter before and after, he's specifically speaking about spiritual gifts. In chapter 12, he explains how all the grace gifts are needed in one body, and the community needs to be united in its diversity of giftings. And then in chapter 14, after this chapter, he speaks of striving for the gifts that most build up the body, and using them in an ordered way for the benefit of all, both those in the church and those who are being witnessed to. So we come to 1 Corinthians 13, and Paul has three main things to say. The first paragraph is about the necessity of love. The next is a definition of love in this context. And the last paragraph is about the permanence and superiority of love over other spiritual things. And it actually begins this sort of description of love with the last verse of the chapter before, which I asked Anne to read, to add to the reading. And I will show you a still more excellent way. Paul is giving the context for all Christian spiritual life. Now, way in the New Testament refers to the whole way of life involved in following Jesus. The love that Paul talks about here is an overarching, all-embracing style of life, not something that just can be considered as another spiritual matter alongside the spiritual gifts that he's been talking about. And the word translated more excellent, a more excellent way, actually has the sense of beyond measuring. He's speaking to a community who were measuring themselves against each other. That's a common human behavior, isn't it? But he was presenting this as something beyond their scale of measurement. I will show you a way of life that is beyond measurement. And then the first paragraph, verses 1-3. I'm sure you know it really well, but if you can follow it in a Bible, it's probably worthwhile. Some of the Corinthian Christians regarded speaking in tongues, that is other unknown human languages or the languages of heaven, and they regarded that as primary evidence of being spiritual. Now, there's a lot of Pentecostal groups that have a similar sort of idea. But the Corinthian Christians even regarded it as proof of having arrived in that final spiritual state. So Paul comes in personal. Though he's speaking about them, he uses his own behavior as the example. He writes that if he, as a tongue speaker, does not have love, it's not the tongues, but he himself who is just a noisy sound. And in fact, a gong in particular was an instrument of pagan worship. So he may have been pointing back at their pagan roots. If they don't have love, they're just noisy pagans. Then he lists other spiritual giftings and he exaggerates them a bit. If I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, if I have all faith so as to remove mountains and don't have love, then I am nothing. It's not the giftings themselves that are nothing, but the person becomes nothing. This is particularly aimed at those who regarded themselves as spiritually superior because of their obvious spiritual giftings. But what he says next is relevant to the other group within the church as well. If I give sacrificially, give everything to charity, that's quite clearly an exaggeration of something good to do. If I hand over my body so that I may boast, this seems to refer to what Paul clearly says elsewhere he does boast about, his sufferings in his body for the sake of their salvation, his being beaten, going hungry, and that sort of thing. Even these actions, which those who aren't into spiritual giftings would think of as showing a person to be a really keen Christian, doing even these seemingly loving deeds without having love as a way of life gains nothing. So, what Paul is stressing here is that this nothing we do, that nothing we do can actually prove that we are spiritually superior or even spiritual at all if we don't have that life of love. He doesn't say that any of these things in themselves are not good. Obviously, in other places he commends them. And it's not a matter of these things or love, or even these things motivated by love, but these things by a person whose whole way of life is love, is characterized by love. And otherwise, that person's life adds up to zero before God. Love gives meaning and appropriate flavor to all other Christian living. So to apply this to today, Paul might say, we can't prove our spirituality by how much Bible we can quote, by how much theology we have, by our correct or proper doctrine, by the style of worship service we have, the amount of praying or singing in tongues we might do, by the number of converts we lead to the Lord, by our programs for social justice, by how much we give or how much we serve our local community. If love doesn't characterize our lives, we are not spiritual Christians at all. And note, Paul himself has sometimes been thought of as harsh and unloving in the things he's written. Some people have tried to make out Paul to be, not very loving at all. But he couldn't have used himself as the example here if he hadn't been a clear example of love to them. So what he's writing about is something that he has done. So what does it mean to have love? Well, to begin with, it's clear in the passage that love is not a feeling. He's not talking about a feeling at all. All the words used to describe love in verses 4-7 are verbs, not adjectives. But you can't really see that in the English translation. A better, though more awkward way of saying it or translating it might be, love is to be patient. Love is to be kind, to act kindly. Love is not to be envious, or to brag, or to act arrogantly, or behave rudely. Love does not insist on its own way. It is not being irritable or resenting others, etc. Now, they're all verbs. They're not adjectives. So these are what love does. They're not abstract or theoretical descriptions. Love is a collection of intentional actions. It's practical. It's not sentimental, but it's behavioral. Paul goes on to explain the character of this love he's talking about, and he does so particularly with reference to the Corinthian Christians. Love is being patient and acting kindly. These are the passive and active responses to others. You're being patient. That's not just waiting well or enduring suffering, but it's also the idea of enduring injuries without retaliation, never giving up. You know, it's like being patient when you feel like something should be moving at a certain pace, or that, you know, people should be acting in a certain way, but they're not, and you wait for them. That sort of patience. It's being kind. That's the act of goodness on another's behalf. We're told a lot about being kind in today's society. It's the idea of being actively good. It doesn't come from anywhere else really other than Christian idea of love. And then there's five characteristics of Corinthian behavior that show they were not loving. That's what Paul addresses in the next verse or two. There was the envy that one group had of the other's grace giftings, the boasting practiced by those with the giftings, the pride or arrogance they had in their giftings, their tongues or knowledge or service. And then the word translated rude, which means behaving improperly towards others or shamefully. Like, for example, the way they did when they didn't share food at the Lord's table, as mentioned in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Self-seeking, insisting on its own way, as the Corinthians demonstrated in their arguments over food offered to idols, for example. These are all characteristics that the Corinthians had obviously evidenced. And Paul was saying, no, the opposite actions are what love is. And the Corinthians needed to realize that love is not irritable or easily angered and keeps no record of wrongs. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing or evil, gossiping about what is not right about others, but rejoices in the truth, in what is right. Love is the opposite of the behaviors that divide a community. Paul sums up his description of love with a magnificent description of self-sacrificial love, which bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. The way Eugene Peterson paraphrases that in the Message version of the Bible. Love puts up with anything, trusts God always, always looks for the best, never looks back, but keeps on going to the end. And then we come to the last part of discussion, as love is the more excellent way. There, Paul points to the permanence of love compared to the temporary and partial grace giftings. What is permanent must dictate how what is only here for the present period functions. Paul emphasizes again that the giftings are not in themselves evidence of being spiritual, and are certainly not evidence that heaven is already here on earth. Rather, they are only partial and for the present, and like a child puts away childish things when they become an adult, or a mirror reflection is a poor substitute for seeing the real person, especially in their sort of polished mirror, metal mirrors that they had. These grace giftings will no longer be needed when heaven is fully a reality, when we will know God fully as he already knows us. And we don't need the Spirit to reveal the things of God to us. For example, we won't need the grace of healing when all things have been made whole in the presence of God. We won't need great faith to know God's power, for example. Yeah, spiritual gifts, good as they are only for serving others and building up the body in the present age. They will pass away as this present age passes away. Christian love, which the Corinthians were lacking in, is the more excellent way as it continues into eternity. Faith, hope, and love, they're the present ongoing reality of Christian life. And Paul uses those words, that combination of words elsewhere in his writings too. However, faith will one day become sight. Hope will end in fulfillment. But love will remain the way of life into eternity. Now, can we grasp how fundamentally different that biblical idea of love is from the world around us? Does the way the world talks about love all the time make it difficult for us to put into practice the love that Paul exhorts us to? So the love that Paul describes is clearly Christ-like. The love God has for us and what we are called to do. So God's love for us is not motivated by our loveliness. It is his nature. It comes out of his being, self-originating. In our world, we tend to love because the person before us has something we find lovable, or because we have compassion for them, or in some other way our feelings are aroused. God calls us to his sort of love, not dependent on who we are loving. None of the actions described by Paul here are dependent on the person we are loving. In the world at the time he wrote, dominated by the Greek and Roman mindsets, such self-sacrificial love was not regarded as rational. And it was certainly not valued as a virtue at all. All the good works and the philanthropy and such like could be practiced by pagans, but the godly character of the love that Paul was describing is something that only Christians were enabled to live by the Spirit within them. So having that sort of love is the only distinguishing characteristic of the spiritual Christian. And the same applies just as much to today. The world does not regard this sort of self-sacrificial action as being essential for success or for self-fulfillment and happiness. So how does our surrounding worldly culture affect how we love and think about love? An example of this can be seen in the approach to marriage and how love functions there. The Western ideal of romantic love, of feelings aroused and expressed between a man and a woman, leading to commitment and marriage, that's not even held everywhere. Many in our international congregation in Eindhoven came from cultures where marriages were arranged by parents and families. And the man and woman learned how to love one another practically in order for the relationship to work well. And they did, we saw it all the time. That sort of love is about deciding to do what is good for a person. For Christians in these cultures, the biblical teaching is much easier to understand. These are the actions one needs to do in a real Christian marriage, as well as towards other Christian brothers and sisters. And naturally, positive feelings follow, but they're not the driving force. However, in Western culture in particular, feelings are regarded as very, very important. People are encouraged to do what they feel like doing unless it will hurt someone. If you do something good but you don't actually feel like doing it, it's regarded somehow as less authentic, as less authentically good. Being authentic and having integrity in Western culture usually means that your feelings must line up with your actions and attitudes. Intentions are put almost above the results of actions, even a little bit in our justice system at times. And contrast that, for example, with Jesus and the two sons, that story he told, where the son who actually did what was right, what his father had asked him to do, even though he said he wasn't going to, was the one who was right, not the one who said he was going to do it but didn't do it. Yeah, in this world, if we don't feel loving, then our actions for the sake of another are not regarded as loving in the same way as if we did feel loving. If a person whom we show patience or kindness towards does not feel good about it, then it's not regarded as loving in the same way as if they did feel the action to be loving. Being loving in today's world is supposed to take the feelings of the person we're loving into account. Even if what they want or feel like is not actually what's best for them. All of these approaches are not biblical at all. Paul never says that the love he describes feels good. Because of the worldly ideas about what love actually is, we can even act as though the mission of the church is to gather like-minded and likeable people together. Then perhaps in that sort of community, it would be easy for us to love, or rather even to feel the love. But true love is not measured by how good it makes us feel. In the context of what Paul says here, it would be better to say that the measure of love is how well it allows for difference and disagreement without there being division. It's a different sort of ideal. This love is a lifestyle of intentional actions, not the good feeling the world describes as love. This Christ-like love is the sort of love that's needed to create, sustain, and build Christian unity. It's the sort of love that is essential for all Christian living, for being a Christian community, and for its shared worship. It can seem like this life of love is a noble but far-off ideal. But Paul does not present love like this. This sort of life of love is within reach of each one of us because it's the life of Jesus, the life inspired by the Spirit and enabled by the Spirit, the life we inherit as members of Christ's body. We love because God first loved us in that way. And Paul's purpose in describing this life of love is that it will bring the unity in the church that Jesus prayed for. That unity, that we may be one so that the world may believe. The one last thought I had about these actions of love, this life of love. It requires us to live in such a self-giving way that we may fear the consequences for ourselves. We may feel vulnerable in the face of those who do not live this life of love. We may feel very vulnerable even when we seek, are with people who, like the members of the Corinthian church, measure themselves and their spirituality as superior to us, for example. But as we live the life of love, we live the way of life of the future as well as the present, the future kingdom which is breaking into the present. I'd like to finish with a quote from Professor Tom Wright. He's one of the greatest biblical scholars and teachers of today. Love is God's river, flowing on into the future, across the border, into the country where there is no pride, no jostling for position, no contention among God's people. We are invited to step into that river here and now and let it take us where it's going. Let us love.